Okay, so this talk will be considerably more sort of general and less specific in scope, and there will be only a small part in the middle which has some relation to bacterial evolution. So mostly I will address very classic and general questions in evolutionary theory. And this is joint work with two students in Köln, Jasper Franke and Alexander Klürzer, and with Arjan de Visser from the University of Wageningen. So this is basically a talk about fitness landscape. So I want to start with some images from this very classic paper by Sewell Wright from 1932. So these are two figures from that paper, and they sort of illustrate the two essential issues that I want to discuss. So on the left side, what Wright is showing are sort of genotype spaces. So the notation is such that you have the wild type here, and you have different mutations. Like here, there are two mutations, AB, and here you have the double mutant A, where both mutations are present. Here you have three mutations, four mutations, and so on. So you get these hypercubes, which are essentially represent the geometry of these genotype spaces. And Wright realized that in many cases, if you think about a fitness landscape is just a function defined on this space. So to each genotype, you associate a fitness. And Wright realized that in many cases, or generically, you probably have to expect that such a fitness landscape will have multiple peaks. And this is what is illustrated here. Now, of course, it's sort of difficult to draw a function in a sort of reasonably illustrative plot on such a high-dimensional space. So Wright sort of reduced this to a two-dimensional landscape, and then you have here these peaks and the valleys in between. And he says that an essential problem in the theory of evolution is to understand how populations get from one fitness peak to another, right? So there will be innumerable, so there will be typically selection will carry a species to the nearest peak, but there will be innumerable other peaks that will be higher but which are separated by valleys. And so the problem is to find a mechanism by which you can find the population can find its way from lower to higher peaks. Now, I should say that already early on, this was sort of a somewhat controversial issue. Fisher, for example, didn't believe in the existence of multiple fitness peaks. He had this idea that because of the high dimensionality of these spaces, typically there will just be one optimum, and it will always be possible by selection to reach it. And I think to some extent this controversy has remained, because obviously the fact that you have to cross a valley to get from one peak to another is true in two dimensions, but it's not at all obvious that this is also true in these high dimensional spaces, where you could imagine that it's always possible to sort of find ways around regions that you don't want to go into. So that's sort of the general theme. This is sort of the story of evolutionary accessibility and fitness peaks. Now, this is nowadays these structures in fitness landscapes are discussed often in the context of a certain type of epistasis. So let me just briefly define the sort of formal setting that I want to consider. So suppose you have a certain number of loci at which you can either have a mutation or not have a mutation. So you can describe to the extent that you only consider these L possible loci, you can describe your genotype by a sequence where you put a 1 if the mutation is there and a 0 if the mutation is not there, and then you have a fitness assigned to these two to the L genotype. So you have some function W of sigma. And epistasis in its most general form simply means that there are interactions between the effects of different mutations, which means that the value or the change in fitness at one locus, where you go from 0 to 1 at one particular locus, depends on whether the other mutations are present or not. And sign epistasis is a particularly strong form of epistasis, where a mutation at a given locus can be either beneficial or deleterious depending on the state of other loci. So not only the magnitude of the effect depends on the state of other loci, but also the sign. Okay, and this is sort of an illustration in the simplest case of two loci, how this works. So suppose you start here at this wild type 0, 0, And now suppose you have a mutation at the first locus, so you see here the fitness goes down. Now if you, on the other hand, if the second mutation is already present and you mutate the first locus, you see that fitness goes up. So this is sign epistasis. This is particularly what is called also reciprocal sign epistasis, because you have two mutations where in for both mutations the sign of the effect of the mutation depends on the state of the other mutation. Okay? Yes?
So if I try to represent it as a Ising model, right?
Yes.
Then basic epistasis is the existence of a JIJ of a coupling between two strands.
Any kinds of interactions, right. Yeah.
So is there any experimental evidence for existence of third-order couplings?
Okay, that's a good. Maybe I will show a number of experimental examples. So certainly there, there is strong experimental evidence for epistatic interactions. Now, whether essentially, of course, what you then would have to do, given a certain function W of sigma, you can always decompose it into couplings of different orders. And I would think that you would, if you do that empirically, you would just find that all couplings are present. I mean, there is no reason to expect things to be restricted to second-order couplings. So but I'm not aware that this analysis has actually been done. But it would be, rather, since we have a lot of data, it would be rather easy to do that. It's actually a good point. Okay, so now what you see in this picture, in this simple case already, is of course that this is a two locus landscape with a reciprocal sign epistasis, and you see that there are two fitness peaks, right? So there's obviously a relationship between the existence of multiple peaks as envisioned by Wright and this notion of sign epistasis. So in some sense, you can say that the existence of peaks, of local peaks, multiple peaks, is one manifestation of sign epistasis. And in fact, you can easily formulate a kind of formal proof that in order to have multiple fitness peaks in a fitness landscape, you have to have reciprocal sign epistasis. This turns out to be a necessary but not sufficient condition. Now, there is sort of one empirical point about local or multiple fitness maxima, which has been emphasized in this review by Whitlock and collaborators, which is in some sense that you can never prove their existence empirically, right? Because what a fitness maximum means is that all the mutations reduce fitness, but of course you never have access to all the mutations. So you might find that within the set of mutations that you consider, all of them reduce fitness, but that doesn't mean that there might not be some other mutation which would actually increase fitness. And as I mentioned already in the beginning, the importance of these local peaks is still somewhat controversial, because although naively you would think that fitness maxima are obstacles to adaptation, because you have to cross valleys to get from one maximum to the other, as long as we don't understand the geometry of these sequence spaces better, it's not obvious that you cannot generically sort of go around them. So in some sense, this is sort of a classic manifestation of sign epistasis, but it might be better to look at sign epistasis from a somewhat different point of view, and this is this notion of accessibility of mutational pathways, which was introduced also by Weinreich and collaborators in the context of sign epistasis. Now, what do I mean by a mutational pathway? So I just mean that you consider two genotypes in this genotype space, and you look at a path of single mutations going from one to the other, okay? So you just do one mutation at a time. And if the initial genotype is lower in fitness than the final genotype, we say that such a pathway is selectively accessible if fitness increases monotonically along the path. So it's basically a monotonically uphill path connecting two genotypes. And a nice property of this notion of accessibility is that one can show that sign epistasis implies that at least some paths are not accessible in this sense, and vice versa. So if you have, so there's a one-to-one correspondence between the presence of sign epistasis and the reduction of accessibility in this sense. Yes?
So I have, I don't know if this is relevant to the rest of the talk, but I have a question about this Gouvernet statement that you cannot empirically prove assign epistasis and existence of local minima. So it looks like it's trivial to do in some cases where you have, for example, six coding family and you have two synonymous changes between the species or within population, or with RNA structures where you have destabilizing mutation following by stabilizing mutation, restoring the pairing. So isn't this...
Well, but the question is whether, you know, whether you can have some mutation somewhere completely else, somewhere else in the sequence that would compensate for that.
But you see compensatory events, right? You see
right,
them in
sure,
the data.
Sure.
And you see that they probably went through a very unfavorable state.
Wait, but this is not a question of whether valley crossing, you can show maybe that valley crossing occurs.
Yeah, right.
But that's not what this is asking. This is saying, it can show that it has to occur
to get off the peak where the old way off is valley crossing. Of course, the other, you know, the path going around might be very long and might be very unlikely, but it's sort of formally...
You're saying that this is a statement about non-existence of the trajectory which never goes down.
Yes.
Couldn't you just do all single point mutations, measure fitness, and show that all...
Yeah, sure. I mean, in principle,
that's not that unreasonable.
Sure. I think Whitlock refers more to the sort of organismal level. I mean, you know, for extremely simple systems, I think this can probably be done. But it's sort of a generally a difficulty with this concept.
Is there anything different between selectively accessible and what other people have called adaptive walks on the landscape?
Well, so an adaptive walk, it's clearly related. So an adaptive walk essentially means that it's a population dynamics in a certain evolutionary regime, and it means that you sort of go uphill until you hit a local maximum typically. So that would be an adaptive walk. Adaptive walks follow accessible trajectories in that sense. But and this will be on the next slide. I mean, here I'm not going to discuss population dynamics at all. I just want to define things just purely in terms of the structure of the landscape. Okay, but of course, adaptive walks do exactly follow these kinds of accessible trajectories. Okay, so let me get to that, because this is, I think, an important issue that I want to sort of clarify from the very beginning. So this notion of accessibility that I'm using here makes no statement about the probability that a pathway will actually be realized. So if you have a given evolutionary scenario, you have a population evolving on this fitness landscape, then the existence of accessibility of accessible path doesn't tell you whether this path will be found by the population, you know, whether it will be taken. And I want to sort of purposefully not discuss this in this talk, because whether or not or how easy it is for a population to adapt on a given landscape, of course, depends not just on the landscape, but it depends on population parameters such as n mu that we heard about in the previous talk and the strengths of selection. So the notion of accessibility that I'm using here is sort of adapted to this so-called strong selection, weak mutation regime, where selection is strong, which means that you basically only go uphill. You cannot fix deleterious mutations. Mutation is weak in the sense that you just have one mutation at a time. So this is exactly this adaptive walk regime. And then adaptation can proceed only along accessible path. And you can also assign a weight to a given path by just taking the product of the fixation probability. So for each step, you have a kind of fixation probability. And the product of those fixation probabilities will give you a kind of weight of a path. But here, I will sort of ignore these different weights. I will treat all accessible paths more or less on an equal footing. So I will only ask whether these accessible paths exist, and I will not discuss, you know, how likely they are to be found. Yeah.
This is a technical point, you know, but like n mu much less than one is not actually a sufficient condition for the trajectory not to be sensitive to two step fixed values two steps away, right?
Why not?
Even with nu much less than one, it can tunnel to.
But with only square, with kind of a small, very small. I mean, this is a small.
Yeah, right. I mean, what I mean is that, okay, this of course, it's always a question of time scales, right? I mean, so accessible path, it will go along rapidly. So if it encounters a valley, then this will take much longer. And so in the limit that this, in some sense, goes to zero, it will never happen, okay? So just to make that clear, so I will not discuss population dynamics. I only want to talk about the structure of the landscape. And then since I was advised by Michael to count on not getting through more than the introduction of this talk, let me also next already present the punchline so that you know what will come at the end. What is sort of the take-home message? The statistics of accessible mutational pathways is a good measure of landscape ruggedness. Now, I want to make this more quantitative, so I want to look at two quantities in particular. So first of all, I have a fitness landscape which is sort of finite dimensional, finite number of loci. It has somewhere a global fitness maximum, and I'm looking at the path, the accessible path to that maximum, and I want to study two quantities. You'll see later why. First of all, we ask, what is the probability to find at least one accessible path? So this is sort of a measure of accessibility. Is the maximum accessible at all? And the second quantity, and you'll see why it's sort of important to distinguish these two, is the mean number of accessible paths. And this has some relevance for what people call predictability of evolution. So predictability means, given a fixed landscape, if you run your population dynamics several times, will you see the same trajectory or will you see different trajectories? And so if there are many accessible paths that are available, you might expect that predictability will be low because there will be many different options. Of course, this will in detail also depend on the weight of these paths. But to begin with, if there are many, you might expect that predictability is reduced.
So when you say probability to find at least one accessible path, does that mean if I'm anywhere in the landscape at random, what is the probability that a path touches that point?
Yes, actually more specifically, so in most of the analysis we actually ask, suppose the L-fold mutant is the most fit and the wild type is the least fit, what is the probability of finding a path from the wild type? But you could also, it doesn't make much of a difference, you could also ask from any point. I mean, this is...
You always look at an ensemble of landscape.
This is, okay, so probability meaning, yes, so that's of course within an ensemble of landscapes, or in a given landscape, of course, either there is a path or there isn't, right? You're right. I mean, in order to say what probability means, I have to tell you what the ensemble is. Also, we want to, in principle at least, think about these quantities on large scale. So although, of course, the data sets that are available typically only encompass a handful of loci, in principle, we would like to know what happens as the number of loci goes up, right? So we make this landscape, we increase the dimensionality. And then the main conclusion is that in this limit, so when as L gets big, accessibility is high in the sense that the probability to find at least one accessible path becomes rather large. So that's in some sense, I think, the surprising conclusion.
The understanding of the original Fisher's argument about the high dimensionality meaning high accessibility. So isn't this the same statement as the Fisher's original statement, or this is a different statement?
Well, this might be, yes, but I think it's probably, a more qualified statement. But I think it is, of course, a kind of intuition that people have sort of formulated in various contexts. But I think we make it more specific here, yeah. So that's the one thing. So accessibility is high. And predictability is low in the sense that you typically also have many alternative pathways. And finally, so a sort of methodological feature that I think is of interest is a specific kind of analysis that we do on a rather large empirical fitness landscape, which sort of addresses this issue of ensembles, because for a given system you typically just have one landscape, right? So you have some gene, as I'll show you later, and you have some mutations, and you can sort of try to map out that one landscape, but then you just have one. So it's not clear how you can use these probability concepts. And so our idea is to look at subsets of mutations, okay? So you have a certain number of mutations, and you select some subsets of these mutations, and that defines an ensemble, and within that ensemble you can then you can then look at things, for example, as a function of the number of mutations. So that's sort of the subgraph analysis is sort of an important aspect of this. Yeah.
Why is predictability low if there's many alternative pathways? I thought then the mean number is high.
Yes, so that means that
this is a reciprocal.
You cannot predict which.
Yeah, I understand. Okay, I thought so.
Sense, yeah. I should probably say constrains predictability or something like that. Okay, so now we can sort of try to become more concrete. So let me first show you a couple of examples of empirical fitness landscapes, which sort of motivated this study. And the first one, this is I think by now a rather famous example, this work by Weinreich and collaborators on the TEM1 beta-lactamase enzyme. So this is an enzyme that confers resistance to E. coli against certain types of antibiotics. And in particular, in this study, the wild type was, which is to begin with not resistant to this particular antibiotic, becomes highly resistant by acquiring 5 mutations. Okay, so the numbers here, this is of course not really fitness. What this is a kind of, is essentially the concentration of the antibiotic at which the bacteria can still grow. So this goes up from 0.09 to about 4,000 after these 5 mutations. And so these 5 mutations were at that point already known from clinical studies and so on. So what Weinreich and collaborators did was to manufacture all the intermediates. So in this case, so this is in my notation, L equal to 5. So there are 32 different combinations. So these different combinations were manufactured. And then you could look at this accessibility question. That is, you can ask, you know, how many pathways are there from the wild type to the fivefold mutant along which resistance only increases? Now, there are L factorial pathways, so in this case, there are 120 of them, and 18 of them turn out to be accessible. Okay, so that was sort of the main point of this paper, saying that, in fact, the large fraction, the large majority of pathways are not accessible, and this picture shows 10 out of those. And the weights of these arrows sort of also reflect the weight of different, the width of these arrows reflect the weight of the different pathways. So this is, you know, an example of rather strong sine epistasis. Nevertheless, this landscape doesn't have multiple peaks. So this only has one peak in this resistance measure, which is the fivefold mutant. Okay. So this was essentially, you know, what was at the beginning of our study. So the question that I asked myself was, you know, this 18 out of 120, in what sense, you know, is this something like a typical number, or what should you sort of expect in other contexts? Now, a related study is this one. So this is again about resistance of the malaria parasite. In this case, there are 4 mutations that are involved. And so here you see this resistance measure for the 16 genotypes. Now this is a case actually where there's also a local maximum. So the global maximum is here, the fourfold mutant. But if you look at this 1001, for example, if you look at its neighbors, you see that they all have lower resistance. So this is a case where you have one local maximum. And again, you can sort of analyze these pathways. So in this case, there are 24 of those, and the red ones are the accessible ones. Okay, so the black ones are those where there is at least one step going down in fitness. And again, you can look at the weights, and you see that the weight is sort of concentrated on these two pathways. And in fact, the one with the highest weight is also the one that you see in natural populations. So if you look at the spreading of this resistance in natural populations, you see that these mutations tend to come in a certain order. And this order corresponds exactly to this dominant pathways, which sort of tells you that this notion of accessibility makes sense also in the population context. Yes.
I'm not entirely sure anymore, but I remember when I read this paper that that I didn't agree with how they calculated the probability to go to
the weights.
Yeah, they, I don't know, did they ignore mutation rates?
Well, I mean, one difficulty with calculating the weights here is that they don't actually have fitness, right? So the measure, they have this resistant measure, and they basically treat this resistance measure as a proxy for fitness. But this is, of course, not in a population genetic context. You really would like to know what is the fitness advantage.
And there's always some assumption that there's only one mutant.
No, if it's monotonic, then...
Yeah, it's monotonic, but the question...
But all of the red ones are monotonic.
Yeah, but the question is, how do you get this weight? So the weight involves, strictly speaking, should involve fixation probabilities, but those, of course, you only know if you know fitness. So in that sense, of course, you're right. I mean...
For malaria, it's maybe not okay to assume that NU is always much lower than
that's also possible. Yeah, I mean, yes.
There is never competition between the two.
Right. No, you're perfectly right. Of course, when NU is not small, then the calculation of the weights also becomes more complicated and so on. So that's also the reason why I don't really want to discuss it here. But it just, to explain what these red, these thick lines mean, I have to say that, yeah.
And those, by the way, are sequential, and you have each single mutation has to reach fixation in the whole population before the next mutation enters, or if there is competition, or there's...
Well, that's again a question of what is n times mu. So if n times mu were small, this would be the case. But of course, if n times mu is not that small, I have no idea what it, what it is in this case.
But it seems that it's sequential like fixation.
Well, this picture doesn't really say anything about that. I mean, this picture is just organizing these pathways, and the weight here is calculated under the assumption that there is sequential fixation, but there's no population dynamics behind this picture.
Just to back up a bit, because I realized I didn't understand something earlier. Your definition of path and pathway between two states is only to change one thing at a time.
Yes.
As only the things that... So the zeros can only become ones.
Yes.
They've got to go via two.
Sure. There's only zeros and ones.
You're not allowed to go. You're not allowed to change them and change one of them back and then go forward again.
That's right. So I'm assuming. I think I might have said that somewhere, but maybe not. So I'm only looking at. At directed path, so I know where the global maximum is, and I only allow for paths which go towards that maximum one at a time. In principle, of course, you could make, you might, and this has been done. I mean, on this Weinreich data, there has been an analysis which included also, all possible paths, not the shortest ones. The reason again why I focus on the shortest ones is because I assume, if mu is small, then having more mutations than you need to get to the fivefold mutant in this case would take much too long. So in that sense, the short ones are the ones that are sort of relevant. Yeah.
So actually, to go back to the next slide, the one, or yeah, slightly different question about this that maybe pertains to the rest of what you're going to talk about is that this ignores the probability of getting stuck on a non-accessible path, right? So it could be the best accessible path actually is dangerously close to pathways that are dead ends.
Yes.
In which case, those pathways will almost never show you evolution to the, the global peak.
Certainly. I mean, but this is again, a question that would depend on the population parameters whether this happens or not. But you're perfectly right. I mean, this is the whole question of actually finding them. Is completely left out.
A topological question, not one about the population parameters. It's just that there's dangerous paths that you can get stuck on that have lots of,
Sure, but then you would have to quantify what that exactly means, dangerously close. But it's a very good point, yeah, sure.
But it is a population statement, because if you have a lot of dice around zeros and Z, what is dangerous actually is less, becomes smaller, right? I mean, one of them will, you have a billion guys over there, one of them will find the right pathway. even if it's very, very well, tall, it is a bad.
But you can make this argument entirely for topological. Yeah. For example, yeah. This maximum here, 1001, it could have extremely high weight. So you would kind of always go there, and then you would be stuck.
1000 was one, the best.
So the one that you, the one that you denoted as a local optimum, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, I think mm-hmm. it was 1001.
Yes,
it?
Yes, yes.
So that one could have had the highest, steepest descent in the, ascent in the beginning.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
And then I think that it is topological. Yeah.
That's right. I mean, but again, you know, how much the steepest descent would be favored, or ascent would be favored, again, depends on the population parameters.
Right. This parachute experiment, so there's a combination there, right? So in malaria, as opposed to...
Okay, you know more than I do.
But I'm not sure if they considered recombination here, I mean, because we just can...
Yeah, of course, recombination would sort of change this. Yeah, sure. I mean, this would certainly. But you know, I'm just saying that, and this is sort of the conclusion of this paper, that they find sort of a dominant pathway, and this seems to match what is seen in the field. So, but of course, there could be complications that make this picture invalid. Okay.
Should we assume asexual for the rest of the talk?
Oh yes, oh yes.
I didn't say that. He yeah. doesn't even want to think about population.
I'm not talking about populations at all, but in particular, yes, there should only be mutations. Okay, so the third example is work that we were involved in, which is, and this is sort of important because this is sort of what I want to build on later. So this is a fitness landscape that was originally obtained by Ariane de Visser. And it's a large data set. It contains 8 mutations, and this is a subset of 5 mutations. So in this paper in 2009, we analyzed 2 subsets of 5 mutations from that data set. And this is sort of the way I want to represent these landscapes in the following. So you have here the genotypes, there are arrows, and these arrows always point in the direction of increasing fitness. Now, this is actually a case where the mutations from the wild type are not beneficial, but they are deleterious. So these are deleterious mutations that were chosen mainly as markers. So they should be easily detectable phenotypically. I'll tell you in a moment what they are. And so here, you know, you should always think of things sort of moving back to the wild type in some sense. So here, the question of accessible pathway simply means you follow a pathway and you ask, you know, is it possible to get here to the wild type along a path always following the direction of the arrows, okay? And if you count in this case, again, there are 120 possible pathways, 25 out of those are accessible. But this landscape also has several local fitness peaks. There are 3 of those, and these colors indicate the in some sense the basin of attraction of the different peaks, in the sense that I assume that I follow a steepest ascent walk. So at every point I always go in the direction of largest fitness increase, and under that dynamics you see that the red is sort of the basin of attraction of this one, and so on. Okay, so this guy doesn't have any basin of attraction at all. Okay, so that's sort of the way I want to represent these data.
Sorry, how does it work? It's a local optimum?
Yes.
One,
yes.
But it doesn't have...
Well, all the neighbors go into it, but for none of these neighbors is it the steepest ascent. Okay.
Ah, okay. But the wild type is also an optimum.
Of course, yeah, yeah. And you see that the wild type has a very large basin of attraction. So all the black ones go to the wild type.
Okay,
so this is sort of the data set that I want to dwell on a little bit. This was actually published already quite some time ago. But at that time, the authors were not interested in this issue of science spaces. So this was sort of more before people realized that this could be interesting. So in that paper, they only considered sort of normal magnitude epistasis. That is, the interest was in measuring the fitness just as a function of the number of mutations. So essentially, averaging over the different genotypes, and then the fitness decreases. And the question at that point was just whether this one-dimensional fitness function has curvature or not. and the conclusion here was that there's essentially no curvature, but they didn't look at this more detailed structure. So these are 8 marker mutations, and they all reside on different chromosomes, which makes it easy to combine them. And they have sort of different, most of them different types. So most of them are auxotrophies, which means that they, in the presence of these mutations, this organism, I should say it's a fungus, right? Aspergillus niger is a fungus, if I didn't say that. It's an asexual fungus, and these mutations impede the ability to synthesize certain amino acids. So then you can easily detect the presence of this mutation by growing the fungus on a medium which doesn't contain this amino acid. There are 2 resistances, and there's 1 color mutation. So they were just chosen in order to be easily detectable. Now, with 8 mutations in principle, there are 256 different combinations that you could generate. And in these experiments, they didn't find all of them. They only found 186 out of those. And for those that were found, the fitness was measured basically just as growth rate of this fungus.
Really, just growth rate or competition?
No, for growth rate. And so the question, so there is some range of fitness values. So the wild type is always the most fit. These are all deleterious mutations, and there is some range in this growth rate. Now, of course, the fact that there are some missing strains, of course, you have to deal with that. And so we did a little statistical analysis asking what is the probability that the missing 70 strains were sort of missed by chance in the experiment, right? So there are basically 2 possibilities. Either these missing strains are not viable, or they were just missed by chance in the experiment. And we estimated that there is a very low probability that more than one of those was really missed. So in the following analysis, we just assigned them 0 fitness, okay? So we assume that these 70 missing strains, that in those cases the mutations are lethal, and there's some structure in these lethal mutations. So there turns out to be 1 of these 8 mutations which is particularly strongly involved in lethality, but I will probably not go into that into more detail. So for to begin with, what this just means is that this data set contains it's an 8 locus data set, and there are some holes, okay? So there are some zeros in there, yeah.
So I have a very general question, which maybe for discussion. So this 97 paper, so many, a lot of literature, not your word, but a lot of literature, assumes this one-dimensional epistasis looking at
yes.
Second derivative of the log of fitness,
right.
Number of mutations. So is there, and you look at sort of real picture, multidimensional picture, so is there any mapping between those? So if we, there's a one-dimensional analysis, is there any statement can be made out of those for your multi-dimensional analysis, or we should abandon this one-dimensional?
I think these are just different properties. I mean, you know, you have some complicated landscape and you sort of average it radially and you get some function, but I don't think that of course, well, maybe we can address that when I talk about one of the models. So one of the models that we're using is, in fact, essentially a monotonic, radially symmetric decline with some noise on it, right? So in that sense, this is in principle, you could, of course, take a one-dimensional epistatic function, and then you can add some fluctuations in the second direction and create something that has sine epistasis as well. But I, you know, to first approximation, I would say these things don't really have much in common with each other.
Because, like, emotionally, what the attraction of this one-dimensional approach, that it relates quantitative genetics and evolutionary biology, and the true, the correct, the multidimensional viewpoint is a meeting between the two fields.
Yes.
One is talking about what happens after you get to the peak, the averaging one. And yours is talking about your path to the peak.
Yeah, well, if you think about being on the peak and having some mutational load and so on, which, yeah, okay.
Then the average can be interesting, but when you're away from the peak, it's not really relative to that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious what environment the growth rates were measured in. Do you remember? Was it like a rich medium or?
I can't tell you. Obviously, an environment where everything that all of these strains you need was present, but I don't but apart from that, I don't know. Yeah. Okay. So this is essentially the data set. So now let me tell you how we analyze it. So we're interested in understanding how things sort of change with a mutational scale, right? So we want to know how this accessibility property changes as you add more and more mutations. So what we do is to analyze subgraphs of this. So we have this eight-dimensional hypercube, and we're looking at subsets of it in the following sense. So we look at we pick m out of those eight mutations, and we look at all the so there are L over M choices of that, and we look at all the combinations that contain only these M mutations. Okay, so just to sort of illustrate that, if L is equal to 3, then your sequence space is a cube, and so this cube, so this is illustrated here. So what we're doing, for example, in this case, I'm looking at the subset that contains only mutations at the first and the third locus. So these are these three. So this is like one side of this cube, and here is another side, and here is another side. Okay. So these three subgraphs are the ones that we then analyze for m equal to 2. Okay. So this is sort of in eight dimensions. You can now look at three-dimensional, four-dimensional, five-dimensional subgraphs in that sense, and for each of those, we can do the kind of analysis that I showed you before. So for example, m equal to 4, so there are 70 subgraphs, and this is sort of a sample of these kinds of subgraphs that we get from these data, right? So and so the figures are again made in the same way as before. So you can see here there's quite a variety. So for example, this one here doesn't have any local peaks. There's only a global peak. But still, if you count the number of paths, you find that I think only 10 out of 120 are accessible. And then you have a large number of subgraphs which contain two peaks. And there's one with three peaks, four peaks, and so on. So this way, you can sort of generate some statistics. Of course, you know, these are just different sides of the same cube. So of course, they are not independent. I mean, they overlap quite a bit, and at the moment we're sort of analyzing or trying to analyze more quantitatively what the correlation between different subgraphs is. But for the purpose of this talk, I will just average over the subgraphs altogether. Yeah.
And do you also, in each of these subgraphs, do you average over the hidden locus? Like, you know, if you have 4 out of 5, what does the fifth do?
It's always 0. So the fifth, all the mutations that are not in these graphs are not present, okay?
Not present meaning there is 0.
Yes, 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 yes.
But you could repeat with O1.
Yeah, you could define different ensembles, but this is sort of what we at the moment. So this is, as shown here, So the wild type is always in there, and so in this case, so here the hidden one, you know, would be the one, and so these are not present, right? So those which have a one in the middle are not present.
Ah, now I understand this. Because you have the wild type always in there, you don't
yes.
consider, for example, the bottom surface.
No, that's right. I only look at the sides which contain the wild type. That's right. So that way, and of course, you know, in this Asperger-Gillis-Niger data set, we know, of course, that the fitness on average decreases as I increase the number of mutations. So as I increase M, I go to regions which are sort of more and more reduced in fitness on average. Okay. So this is sort of this defines the ensemble. And now you can do the statistics. That is, you can count the number of accessible paths, and you can count the number of fitness peaks, for example. And you end up with plots like this. So this is now the number. The blue points are the number of accessible paths averaged over this subgraph ensemble, and the red curve is the number of fitness optima. And so you see they sort of increase, and so the number of accessible paths goes up to to maybe 5 or so for m equal to 6. So now the question is, what does this mean? Okay, so is this can we somehow put some quantitative meaning to this? That is, what does this mean in terms of the amount of sign epistasis in these landscapes? And in order to address that, what we do is to look at a couple of models. So we just generate random ensembles of fitness landscapes according to a certain rule that I will describe, and we compare the predictions of the model with what we see here in the data. Okay, so that's the idea. So let me discuss these models. So the first model is a kind of null model, if you will, which is known as the House of Cards model, at least in some communities. So here the idea is simply, and this is very much, you know, in the spirit of statistical physics, if you don't know anything about the fitness values, you just assign them at random. Okay. So each genotype just gets a random fitness value, and then of course somewhere in this in the landscape there will be a global fitness peak, and now we just ask, now we can just count the number of selectively accessible paths from some genotype at some distance d to the global optimum. So in this case we can actually just look at a random starting point. So we just start somewhere, and we'll want to know do we get to the optimum or not. Now the nice thing about this model is that at least the mean number of paths can be calculated from a very simple combinatorial argument. So obviously if I'm at a distance d, then there are d factorial different paths. They just correspond to the different order in which I can make these d different mutations. So if I take it as just one path, then along this path I will encounter fitness values. So there are d fitness values, and they are by definition identically distributed random variables. Accessibility means that these d random variables are ordered in a certain way. And obviously all possible permutations of random variables are equally likely. So the probability that a given path is accessible is just 1 over d factorial. And so you find that on average in this landscape there is always one accessible path to the global maximum. Right? So this is, and this holds for independent of the starting point. In particular, it also holds for if you start from the what we call the reversal genotype, so just the one which has different mutations at all L sites. Okay.
So, question about that analysis: does that you said something earlier about correlation?
Right.
So you'd think that if there was one accessible path, that would make it more likely that there were.
Of course. No, but the key point is this is a single path argument. So the argument is exact because I'm just looking at one path. Of course, if I now look at two paths, they will have a lot of overlap, right? So far we have no idea of calculating, say, the variance of the number of accessible paths, right? Already that becomes much more complicated. But as long as I only look at one path, for this one path, the fitness values that I encounter really are independent, and so this argument goes through. In fact, I mean, we discovered this first numerically, but once you sort of realize it, it's actually rather simple. Okay, so on average, there's one accessible path. Now, you might think that this means, and it's independent of distance, so that's already, I think, in some sense, remarkable, and you might think that this means that accessibility is high, that you will always be able to get to the
variance would somehow go down with d, as same square root of d or something like that.
No, the variance becomes very large. This is the point. So the average is 1, okay, but in order to know whether it's typically you will have an accessible path or not, you have to look at the distribution. And so the distribution looks like this. Okay, so this is the distribution of the number of accessible paths for different values of L, so from 5 to 7 to 9. And what you can see is that there is a very strong peak at 0. Okay, so the probability of not finding any path is very high. And then there is a broad tail of rare events where you can have many paths. So the statement is that this quantity, this number of accessible paths, has very strong fluctuations. And so, you know, once we saw that, it was clear that in some sense the mean is not a very meaningful quantity to consider if you want to know whether the maximum is accessible typically or not. And so therefore, instead of just characterizing the distribution by the mean, we also consider the value of the distribution at zero, which is the probability that there is no path. So one minus that quantity is, you know, a reasonable measure of accessibility. And if you look at this probability of not having any path for the House of Cards model, you see that it's monotonic in L, and it essentially, we believe that it goes to one asymptotically for large L. So for large L, with probability one, you have no accessible path to the global maximum. Okay.
Sorry, L is number of loci, right?
Yes, but so from now on, I mean, here, you know, in this analysis, it actually doesn't depend on where you start. You can just start at some distance d. But in the following, I will always, the data that I show in the following will always be assuming that I start at the, you know, what we call the antipodal point. I mean, just the point where if the wild type is 0, 0, 0, you have all ones or vice versa.
I'm just talking about what under some localization or not here.
I think it probably has more. Well, no, Anderson localization. I don't know. I mean, if I don't see the connection, but if you see it, I mean, okay. But the important statement is that this thing goes to one. Yes.
I'm really struggling with that fifth bullet point from that previous slide.
With what?
If you go back to the slide with the, I'm happy that each path it's got probability 1 over d factorial, they're being accessible.
Right.
I think they're d factorial parts, but they're not independent. You can't just...
But that doesn't matter as long as this is a good... I mean, I must admit, I was very confused about this for a long time, but it doesn't matter because the average is linear, right? I mean, it's just... The average number is just the probability for each of them times their number. I mean, there's no... The fact that they are correlated for the mean doesn't actually enter, but...
But it screws up the variance.
For the variance, yeah. So beyond the mean, there's nothing we can say. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm slightly confused with the next slide. So this now goes against Fisher's intuitive argument.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Very good. Yes.
This is extremely surprising.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the point is that this is sort of a very, this is an extreme case. I mean, this House of Cards model is the in some sense, is the maximum sine epistasis that you can have. It's sort of the worst case. And already, so you see here, there is this green line. And so this is a constrained version of the House of Cards model. And the constraint is that you constrain this antipodal point to be the global minimum. So you just say the maximum is here, the minimum is at the antipodal point, and everything in between is random. So this looks, you know, to begin with, like a rather benign change, but it already changes this probability rather dramatically. And what you see here is that it starts to decline. So that's sort of the main point, that I think this House of Cards model is sort of one extreme case, but everything in all other cases, as you'll see, the Fisher's argument is seems to hold.
So you constrain that just by saying fitness is zero.
Yes, for example. Yeah.
So the problem is really the first step. So what happens in the House of Cards?
Well, I don't think it's the first step. I mean, the point is that the existence of accessible path is sort of a rather non-local. It's a non-local quantity. And
yeah, but you change only one number, right?
That's right. So yes.
In the constraint model, you can always move to all your neighbors. Right?
Yes. Yes.
In the unconstrained model.
Which means that you now, okay, right. But it's not. I mean, I did spend some time trying to, you know, to basically deduce that from that. But
even in the complete House of Cards model, you have a minimum in which you can go to all your neighbors. You can always go from the global minimum. You can always go to all the neighbors.
No, but you start from some, you have a random number, right, where you start from.
Sure.
In the red.
But of course, in the first step, I mean, I think Stefan is right. In the first step, you would probably generically still have a rather, you know, a substantial number of directions in which you could go.
But only half.
Half, yeah, okay, it's half.
But it should actually go up there rather than down, right?
Yes.
The probability that you can do at least one
goes up with. So in that sense, you know, the fact that the antipodal point is a typical point as such doesn't change very much. Yeah. So it's very surprising.
Can I just bother?
But you also have to take more steps to get there.
Sorry?
I still have a problem with the thing before. Right? You say that the distance to the optimum is d.
Yes.
And this is a number of mutations.
Yes.
And you can't have a mutation that you don't need to do anymore. You see what I mean?
No, I don't.
Like to reach the maximum, to reach your peak, you need to have gone to have done five mutations, right?
Yes.
And what you're asking is the order of those mutations. But you could think of. If you did one mutation before another one, then you wouldn't need the other mutations. Did that happen? That doesn't happen in the other way. I'm sorry.
Well, you somehow want to go to all L mutations, right? So it's really just the order.
I mean, what I know, I'm at distance, so I have to do five mutations to get to the maximum, right?
Yeah,
I'm doing one after the other, and so the only freedom that I have is to choose them in different orders.
So you have a lot of mutations that are background dependent, and so you could think that you would have a mutation that would have an effect only in a given background, but not in another one, and so you wouldn't need to do it anymore.
Yeah, but so that what you would see, that would mean that this particular path, I mean, what do you mean you wouldn't need to do it anymore? I mean,
if you're trying to reach the maximum fitness, but you've done mutation five.
But then the maximum wouldn't, I mean, what I assume is that the maximum is where you have all five mutations. So if you,
But in the House of Cards models, it doesn't make sense to talk about background. Background doesn't mean anything. Right? Every mutation puts you to a completely new space.
So they're all additive.
No.
They're not
highly. But there's no background. I mean, in some sense, I guess the background is, if I understand correctly, the background in some sense are those mutations which I don't include in the model, right? But that's, of course, that's sort of, I mean, that this just means that you could somehow make a path which is not on that graph, and that's not.
No, I think your confusion is really that even within the constraint of these L loci, you have complete randomness to assign to the genotypes, not to the mutations. So you don't have
with
random contributions. You have complete randomness.
Each genotype is completely different. Yes, I think that's the point. So it's not you can't really. It doesn't make. Maybe that's the point. I mean, it doesn't make sense to assign. Selection coefficients to individual mutations, because this selection coefficient will be completely different depending on what the others are. That's sort of what sign epistasis means.
An idea was the average overlap between the accessible path, right, as a function of the sequence length. So if you have, let's say, you need D mutations, and then you can put in different order, but this pathways can actually overlap partly.
Yeah,
each other.
Yeah. No, we don't know that. I'm sure they must be highly correlated, but we haven't looked at that.
This kind of may relate to her question. You don't constrain it to only paths of length L, right?
No, I do.
Mutation that you need to switch back and forth.
No, I do. I do constrain it only to the shortest path.
But if there is no path of length L, do you let it?
No, not in this case. I mean, again, because I say, you know, if it's longer, it would again have very small probability because you need to do one more mutation, right? So if mutations are rare, this will not happen. But you know.
So you would say if there is an accessible path that just takes more than L steps, you would say that there's zero accessible path.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. I only count the shortest ones. Yeah.
So do you have any analytical handle on this?
No. Okay. Okay. So this was so the as Shamil already noticed. So this is sort of the exception to the rule that accessibility gets high with large L. But as I said, the House of Cards model is a very extreme case. So now we can sort of go away from this House of Cards model, and there are sort of two standard models that you can use. So one is this Kaufman, is usually called the NK model, but here for consistency I call it the LK model. So this is a model of random epistasis where you define fitness in this way. So you say the fitness is a sum of contributions over the L loci, and the contribution from each locus depends on the state of the locus itself, and it also depends on a neighborhood of K other loci. And so altogether, this function has 2 to the k plus 1 possible arguments. And for each of these arguments, you just assign a random. So here, you know, within this subset, you again do a kind of house of cards assumption. So you just assign a random variable to each of these possibilities. So this contains the 2 limits. If k is equal to 0, then you just have a sum of contributions, independent contributions. There's no epistasis. If k is L minus 1, then each contribution depends on all possible, the whole genotype. So then you're back to the house of cards model. So this k sort of allows you to interpolate in roughness. Now the second model, which is perhaps less well known, was introduced in the context of protein evolution. So here the idea is to just take a landscape which is non-epistatic, or you could also use something that has some curvature if you want. But here we just use something that is non-epistatic. That is, we take a contribution to the fitness, so there's some optimal genotype sigma 0, and there is a contribution which is just proportional to the distance to the optimal genotype, and then there is some random component which is a random function of the genotype. Okay, so this is like there's some average slope, and then you sort of add some fluctuations to that, and the strength of the fluctuations are measured by this parameter theta. So when theta is 0, then you just have the random component, and you're back in the house of cards case. And if theta becomes large, then these fluctuations will not matter, and you essentially have just a constant fitness decay. Okay. So within these two models, you can now again analyze these accessibility properties.
First of all, k equal 1 would be just a standard pairwise sizing, right?
I haven't said how you really choose this neighborhood, but in principle, yes. So for k equal 1, you have just pair interactions, yeah.
Anything solvable analytically for that?
No. Well, it's a spin glass, right?
So, yes.
This is sort of a spin glass type model, but of course you're not interested in the thermodynamics of the spin glass, right? You're sort of interested in other things. There is of course a big literature on this model. So one thing that people have analyzed in quite some detail is the number of fitness peaks in these models. So there's a lot of mathematical literature, proving the behavior, the number of fitness peaks for k and l in various limits, and so on. So, but this accessibility property, as far as we know, has not been addressed. So this is now again the distribution of accessible path in the Mount Fuji model for a small value of l. And so you see here the red curve is the house of cards. Okay, so again there is this peak at 0, and now as you increase theta, you make the landscape smoother. You see that for small theta, nothing much happens. At 0.45, you still have a peak here. But then when theta becomes large enough, you have more and more weight up here, which means that you have a good high probability of having many accessible paths. So the maximum number of accessible paths here is 24. So but at least for small theta, you still have a pronounced peak at 0. Well, this is, there are all kinds of combinatorial odd even effects and so on. But this also shows you that there are these correlations between the paths, right? So there's a lot of that which we don't really understand. So this is a little bit bigger. So now you see things sort of start to look more regular. So again, you have a peak at 0, and then you have some decay which is roughly exponential. And again, when theta is large, you have a lot of weight you get more weight at large n, but still you have a reasonably strong peak at 0.
But so what does large theta mean again? Can you remind me what large theta means?
So theta is just this the coefficient in front of this linear part. So it's a linear function plus a random function, right? So when theta is large, there's a strong linear decay, and the relative strength of fluctuations compared to the linear piece.
Quantify the next curve. So it looks like there is maybe parallel first and then an exponent. I don't know what. It's an odd log scale. But this is
roughly, this is exponential, right?
Yeah, so what's the first part?
The first part, I don't know.
What is the state of which it crosses over from decay to actually grows at large? At large.
I'll show you. So there's, yeah, I think this will be in the, more or less in the next slide, I hope. Right, so the one thing that we can do for this Mount Fuji model is, again, we can calculate the mean number of paths, okay? Which was one for the House of Cards case. Because again, looking at just one path, the probability for a path to be accessible is again the probability for these random variables to be ordered, except that these random variables now are no longer just IID, but they have this sort of deterministic component. This should actually be a theta, I guess, rather than a C. And so this is a problem that you can solve. You can solve it exactly for a particular choice of distribution, which is this Gumbel distribution. So then you get this expression for this accessibility property. In general, you can at least do an expansion in small theta. And so you have this 1 over L factorial part. And then there's another part, which is proportional to theta, which is 1 over L minus 2 factorial. And so at least what this at least means is that as soon as theta is positive, so as soon as you're sort of away from this house of cards limit, the mean of this distribution will grow with L, okay, and it will grow unboundedly with L.
So maybe I like intuition about these models, but they don't really favor sign epistasis. So in real biology, if you imagine selection on the trait, direct selection on the trait, you would have so variant would be positive in individuals with low level of the trait and negative with individuals with high level of the trait, right? So direct selection on the trait induces some sign epistasis immediately, and this sort of biologically relevant scenario may be worse for accessible paths than this one. I
don't know. I mean, they don't. I mean, my intuition is rather that, you know, because of this, because these models contain this random element, there's a lot of sign epistasis. I mean, but I don't have a, you know, because this part is still completely random. So this is still House of Cards like. So in that sense, you know, it will tend to generate a lot of sign epistasis. But I don't have a good feeling for that.
But there are no models which would introduce selection on the trait, because you can have sort of.
Well, there's no phenotypic level here at all, right? Of course, yeah. I mean, if you include a sort of phenotypic level in between, things might look different. I mean, this is all, yeah. And I don't think.
You said about like Fisher's geometric model. Other people have done models for epistasis.
Yeah, but Fisher's geometric model has no sign epistasis, right?
So I think it's Barton, I think, introduced this idea that if you have, I think this is why people prefer apparent, I think, in terms of apparent selection, because as soon as you introduce direct selection on the trait, you already put some sign epistasis in the model. Which makes the whole lot very difficult. And this is a very biological plausible scenario. I can easily believe that there is direct selection on some trait.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but so the statement here is that for this Mount Fuji model, the mean is an increasing function of L. And in particular, for later reference, you might want to notice that this probability for the path to be accessible decays exponentially in L. And that's, in some sense, I think, an important feature. So you have something that decays exponentially. You multiply it with something that grows factorial. So in the end, you get something that grows. Now, the
why is this Gumbel distribution for the randomness?
Well, this is just, it just happens if you just write down the expression for this thing. There is some factorization. And I mean, this is actually, I should say, this model was sort of known by probabilists in the context. And this is actually also the context of this paper, studying records in populations where the mean is shifting. And so the fact that the Gumbel distribution is special was known from that context already, but it's just a fluke. I don't think it's, you know, just, I don't think it has any deep meaning.
just the distribution of highest among a certain number of.
Right, it comes from extreme value statistics, but here the main point is that because of this structure, you know, there are some multiple integrals that you can do that you couldn't do otherwise.
Is this the probability of things being ordered? Because it also appears
yes,
in the order
exactly.
statistics. So,
yeah.
so then it's
a probability. It's a probability of things being ordered.
Of n numbers being in the right order. So it is.
But with this shift, right? So they are not
yeah,
they are not IID, but they are sort of they are shifted.
Right, but the probability of getting ordered random numbers is also
yes
distributed.
Yes. Okay, now, but again, the accessibility, as I emphasized, is a more, you know, reasonable measure for the accessibility, is this probability of not having any accessible path, or rather one minus that. And this, again, we only can determine numerically. And what we see here is that as soon as theta is not zero, so this is, again, the House of Cards case, as soon as theta is not zero, this becomes non-monotonic. So it first goes up with L, and then it goes down. And we believe, and this comes from this this formula here, because if you just, you know, if you multiply this by L factorial, you'll see that you have something like theta times L minus 1 here. So theta enters in this combination of L times L minus 1. And so this means that the location of this maximum here occurs at a scale which is 1 over square root of theta. So as theta gets smaller, you know, this increase will go on for a longer time, but eventually it will come down. And so this is sort of where, you know, Fisher is, if you will, reinstated. So accessibility actually increases with increasing L. The Kaufman model is sort of similar. This is the distribution of accessible path for the Kaufman model. Except that for the Kaufman model, you have to say how you scale things. So as if you increase L, there are sort of different things that you can do with K, right? And we felt that the most reasonable thing, if you compare to the Mount Fuji model, is to say that K should be proportional to L. So you have a certain fraction of loci which interact epistatically. And if you do that, that is, if you plot things as a function of L, with K over L being fixed, then again you see in this probability of not having any accessible path, you see this sort of non-monotonic structure. Okay. Okay. So that's sort of the main point that accessibility quantified by this probability here actually gets larger as L goes up. And so finally, let me just come back to the empirical data and see to what extent they sort of match the picture that we get from this model. Let me first say a little bit more about these lethal mutations, because in the models, as we discussed them so far, there are no lethal mutations, right? In principle, one could sort of throw in some fitness zeros into the model, but we felt that this would make things overly complicated. So we tried instead to estimate how important these lethal mutations really are. And so one thing that you can then look at are these so-called complete subgraphs. So you just look at those subgraphs which don't contain any lethal genotypes. So this is the number of those. And if you remember, L over M is the total number of subgraphs. So for example, for M equal to 4, there are 70, and 19 out of those don't contain any lethal genotypes. And then you can, and I should say, we have a sort of model for the occurrence of these lethal genotypes, which gives these numbers that are shown in brackets. So we sort of understand, you know, the statistics of these lethal genotypes rather well. But so what we did then was to just, first of all, so if you have a pathway that is not accessible, it can be inaccessible for two reasons in this empirical data set. Either it's inaccessible because it encounters a lethal, right? There's a hole somewhere, or it's inaccessible because the fitness goes down. And we try to distinguish these two cases. And what is shown here is the number of paths that you would see if you take into account only blocking by lethals. And what you should see here is that these numbers are typically much bigger than those. So these are the numbers that I showed you before. This is sort of the average number of accessible paths averaged over the subgraph ensemble. And the fact that this is much bigger than that means that, in some sense, most of the path are not blocked, or the effect of blocking by the by lethals is relatively small compared to the effect by blocking by sine epistasis. So that made us confident that that is sort of meaningful to compare the data with these models without lethals. And the last, and this is sort of important, so this is now the probability of not finding any accessible path in the subgraph analysis, that is the fraction of subgraphs that don't contain any accessible path. And you see that, contrary to what I told you before, this is actually monotonically increasing with M. But we interpret this, so you know, what we're sort of predicting is that eventually this should go down. But we're not seeing that because of we're sort of restricted to these small scales. And so we can be a little bit more quantitative. So this is now the, again, the number of accessible paths in the subgraph ensemble. So these are these diamonds here. And there are some error bars. So we try to estimate essentially the effect of measurement error, because obviously the fitness is, you know, the fitness was measured in two replicates. So there's some error in the fitness measurements. And this we try to take into account in a kind of resampling analysis. But what you can see is that the number of accessible path increases, and so that rules out the House of Cards model, and it means that there is a little bit less epistasis than in the House of Cards model, and you can try to estimate how much there is. So these plots compare the empirical data on the one hand to the Kaufman model with k equal to l over 2, which means that half of the sites are interacting epistatically, and in the inset you see a comparison with this Mount Fuji model, where we see that we get a rather good fit to the data with theta equal to 0.25. So, you know, obviously we cannot distinguish between these two models, but this gives you sort of the range of these epistasis parameters, and you can do a more detailed analysis. For example, you can look at the cumulative distribution of the number of paths, so not just the mean, but just ask, you know, how many subgraphs are there with different numbers of accessible paths. And again, this is the data, and this is the Kaufman model with k equal to 2, k equal to 3, and k equal to 1. Okay, so that at least gives you an impression that the description by these models, the data is sort of reasonably well described by these kinds of models. Okay, this is the same thing for m equal to 5. Okay, so I'm
sorry, I didn't understand about the PM of 0.
Yes.
So once you fit your model with theta, let's say the Fuji, and then you have a plot for PL of 0. Is
right.
It compatible with what you see?
I think so. I mean, at least, let me just check here. So I guess, so this is like 0.2. So for the 0.2 case, you would say you should see the decline.
It's okay that you don't see maximum. It's compatible with.
It's sort of compatible. You know, things are not that precise, but basically, you know, we have to end here. So.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So I already gave you my punchline, so I don't have to read it again. Let me just maybe this last point. So you know, so the question is, what is this? What is the reason for this, for the fact that, in this sense, accessibility is increased again in high dimensions? And there is, so there's essentially, you know, we haven't really been able to do anything analytic on these models, but there's this related problem of percolation. So in percolation, you don't really have a fitness landscape, but you just say some of the genotypes are not viable, and then you can ask what is the probability that you find a connected path of viable genotypes from one side of the space to the other. And there it's also known that this percolation threshold sort of goes to zero for L going to infinity. And the mechanism there is, again, that you have, although the probability of having a path is goes down exponentially in the length of the path, this is sort of overwhelmed by the fact that the number of paths is growing factorially. Okay, so this is, I think, you know, very, very roughly or very generally speaking, this the reason how the geometry of this space contributes to making things more accessible, which is probably also the intuition of Fisher, yes.
I think your summary slide should make some statement about this fungus.
The fungus?
And how, well, what have you learned about the fungus or about natural landscapes with the model?
The fungus, well, okay, so the, what we say about the fungus is, you know, this, these estimates of these epistasis parameters. So we have some numbers for those. But we can't really, you know, the significance of these numbers, of course, is not.
Okay. But so we should, okay. We should remember that, okay, there is some epistasis, but not maximum epistasis, right?
Right. That's which is, you know, which is sort of what I think people have said that in other contexts as well, but it's.
But I mean, also, sorry, I sort of spaced out just when you did the comparison, and I thought, I'm sure he'll bring it up again in the summary.
Ah, okay.
You have two different models, right?
Right.
I mean, one fits better than the other, right?
Not really, no.
Not really.
No, I wouldn't say that, no. I mean, you could, I think, you know, this is sort of the most detailed comparison, but you can see that. I mean, in some sense, you know, this Mount Fuji model is easier to fit because you have a continuous parameter, so. But on that level, I wouldn't, you know, I don't think I would like
so
to.
So, like, a K of 2 seems to work.
Yes, K of 2 or theta equal to 0.25. Yeah.
Joachim.
Yeah.
Would it be fair to say that the prediction of that function being non-monotonic is something that is a big prediction, and it is actually quite close that you might see it, so it's not like beyond the expectation.
Right, but you know, what Arjan told me, because Arjan did this analysis of these this eight locus system in his PhD, and he said, you know, for a long time, nobody will do more of that. I mean, this is
but it's very close.
It's not
asking something astronomical to do, right?
Well, it is astronomical because the number of genotypes grows exponentially. And in fact, if you see, I mean, you know, also in Arjan's lab, they are now generating more data for this beta lactamase system, but they are doing sort of four loci at once. I mean, it's just combining things, it's still very laborious. I don't think it's, you know, anytime soon that people will do much more.
So if you randomize the fitness values assigned to single genotype in your network, so how this statistics would look like for that randomized network in a way? So
what do you want to randomize?
So the fitness values that you have, or in a way, the edges that you make within the genotypes on your network.
Yes.
So, is it the topology that you have in the network also dominated by the genotypes that you have and the accessibility, so number of mutations as you go from one genotype to another genotype? So it gets stabilized in a way that there's a certain fitness class given the distribution of fitness values that you have in the whole space. No, you have four high fitness, and there is certain average fitness value in your genotype space.
Mm-hmm.
And then the connections that you make between genotypes are so if it is accessible, it means one should be more.
Yes, right, than the other. Right. Mm-hmm.
Now you can randomize this network, right?
Okay.
So, or randomize the.
You want to randomize the arrows, essentially.
The arrows or the fitness value that you assign to certain genotype. So it means that not necessarily 1000 is less fit than 001. So how does it affect it? The statistics that you have.
I mean, I think you probably want to keep the number of. I mean, you want. I think you want to maybe randomize only within the set of genotypes that have the same number of mutations, because we know that on average the fitness is decreasing with the number of mutations, right? So I don't think you want to sort of randomize everything, but you could probably randomize within these shells of constant distance. Yeah, maybe that might be interesting to see. Yeah. We haven't done that.
You could shuffle the nodes in the shells of
right.
Topologies.
Yeah.
How specific is the topology, basically?
Yeah.
Just a quick question. So this distribution of accessible paths, it has finite variance for some parameters of your model, right? And then if you go to theta, for example, bigger than 1, you saw this broad thing.
Mm-hmm.
You have an idea when it diverges or whatnot? Because it seemed to be exponential for and then at some point it goes like it blows up. So
yeah, but I think it probably
one seemed to be like
I think, you know, I think in some sense this is a kind of percolation transition, right? So I think what happens there is that you start getting, you know, very many accessible paths. So this must be, so maybe one can sort of estimate this as a kind of percolation probability. But no, I don't. I would think maybe this point. No,
one
I shouldn't.
Would be, I shouldn't like, say. Naively, I would assume that one is somehow important.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
That would be a physicist's question, right? Because mm-hmm. the biological system is way away from that. Right?
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well. Yeah, he's a physicist. Okay.